is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
There have been several consecutive failed rainy seasons, and we've come to a situation right now where we're having a significant amount of food insecurity, human displacement.
That's Richard Carruthers of the International Rescue Committee on how Somalia and Ethiopia are among 20 countries in the world most at risk for a worsening humanitarian crisis this year. Details coming up. Also, Mali has accused France of breaching its airspace, and SADC has extended its military mission in Mozambique by 3 months. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Tunisia's main political parties say they will go ahead with planned demonstrations against President Kais Saied tomorrow, marking the anniversary of the 2011 Arab Spring uprising, despite the government announcement that a two-week curfew will begin today. Radwan Masmoudi, president of Center for the Study of Islam and Democracy in Washington, discussed with VOA senior analyst Mohamed Al-Shenawi whether that could pressure the president into a crackdown on the opposition.
I think it could lead to both. The government has announced a total ban on peaceful demonstrations and protests. This happened just 2 days before January 14th, which is the 11th anniversary of the revolution, the day that most political parties have called on their supporters to join a protest against the coup. So I don't think it was a coincidence that the government announced this. The government is clearly using the COVID pandemic as an excuse to ban these demonstrations. And most political parties, however, have announced that they are still moving ahead with these protests and demonstrations against the coup, which potentially see violence and arrests for the first time in Tunisia since the coup of July 25.
The government, as you said, justified its ban on protests and a night curfew as a precaution to prevent the spread of COVID-19 virus, while President Saied's opponents claim the measures are politically motivated. What's your take on that?
I think it's clearly a politically motivated ban on protests because we've seen only a small increase in COVID cases in the last week or two. So it does not justify this total ban on protests. While everything in Tunisia is still normal and we haven't had any other shutdowns other than the ban on protests. So I think it's clear that the government and the regime of Kais Saied is worried and concerned about the size of these protests, because for the first time, these protests have been called for and organized jointly by all the major political parties in Tunisia. So this is the first time that we see all the political parties working together and calling for these protests together. And I think that has made the regime and the government of Kais Saied very concerned and worried about the size of these protests. So potentially these protests could be huge, could be very large and much bigger than in the past. And it is clear that the coup is losing a lot of its early support because it has failed in providing any improvement on the economic level or on the political or social levels. People are suffering in Tunisia, and if anything, things have gotten much worse for most Tunisians since the coup of July 25.
The UN urged Tunisian authorities on Tuesday to immediately release or properly charge former justice minister and prominent Ennahda party member Noureddine Bihairi, and said that the development in Tunisia had deepened the UN's already serious concerns about deteriorating human rights situation in Tunisia. How significant is that to come from the UN?
The statement by the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights is very important and very significant, and is really a reflection of the worsening conditions for human rights in Tunisia. In particular, the case of Noureddine Bihairi, who is a member of parliament, but also former minister of justice and the leader, vice president of the largest political party in Tunisia, the Ennahda party. His arrest without an arrest warrant is very alarming, because his health has deteriorated very rapidly in the past week, and his family, who were able to see him only once in the last 2 weeks, say that he has been on a hunger strike because he was kidnapped by unknown people in plain clothes. They did not even say who they were, and they did not provide an arrest warrant, and he was taken to an unknown location where he was kept without any contact for the first 4 or 5 days. As a result, he's doing a hunger strike, and his health is deteriorating very rapidly. Even yesterday, some politicians and political leaders from various political parties tried to visit him in the hospital in Bizerte, but they were not allowed to enter or to see him. So the UN commissioner demanded that Mr. Bhiri be freed or charged according to the judicial system with clear and specific charges, which still has not happened either. Also yesterday and today, two more bloggers were arrested and prevented from leaving the country because of what they wrote on their Facebook pages and allegedly for insulting President Qais Saied. So all of this shows a very worrisome trend in terms of serious violations against human rights in Tunisia.
That was Radwan Masmoudi, president of Center of the Study of Islam and Democracy in Washington, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shanawi. The World Health Organization reports the surge of a fast-spreading Omicron variant in Africa appears to have peaked and is flattening in most African countries. Lisha Schlein reports from Geneva.
This is a bit of good news for a continent that has been devastated by the COVID-19 pandemic, which is entering its third year. As of now, the World Health Organization reports more than 10 million people in Africa have been infected with coronavirus and more than 230,000 have died. The UN Health Agency reports Africa appears to be emerging from its fourth pandemic wave, driven primarily by the Omicron variant, which quickly overtook the Delta variant to become the dominant strain. After a six-week surge, WHO says Omicron has recorded its first drop in cases. If this trend continues, WHO says it will mark the shortest-lived surge so far on the continent. Abdou Salam Gueye is Director of Emergency Preparedness and Response in WHO's Regional Office for Africa. He says it is premature to let down one's guard, as the latest data was collected during the holiday period, when numbers tend to be underreported.
Over the past week, cases plateaued compared with the week before, dropped by a little bit, 0.2%. Infection have also declined in three of Africa's five sub-regions. Only North and West Africa are currently witnessing an increase in cases.
Anita Graham is in the Department of Pulmonology, University of Witwatersrand, South Africa. She says the Omicron variant has accounted for 95% of all infections during the region's huge fourth pandemic wave. However, she says there have been far fewer severe cases, hospitalizations, and deaths than from the more virulent Delta strain.
However, we are still seeing very serious infections and admissions in patients who are unvaccinated, and also in patients who have comorbidity, and this includes the elderly population. Our vaccination remains the best, most effective way of protecting ourselves and our patients from severe disease, hospitalization, and death.
Unfortunately, WHO officials note just 10% of Africa's population of 1.2 billion is fully vaccinated, compared to 50% of the wider world's population. They say the coming months will be critical in Africa's efforts to improve vaccination rates. They say Africa has the know-how and the tools to tip the balance against the pandemic if it is given the supplies and means to roll out these life-saving vaccines. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Severe drought is affecting more than 3 million people in Somalia and southeast Ethiopia, says the Aid Group International Rescue Committee, IRC. The IRC says the two Horn of Africa nations are among 20 countries in the world most at risk for a worsening humanitarian crisis this year. Mohamed Yusuf reports from VOA's Africa News Center in Nairobi, Kenya.
Ethiopia and Somalia are among 20 countries on the International Rescue Committee's emergency watch list for 2022. Richard Crothers is the IRC country director for Somalia. He says the humanitarian situation in the two countries is not good.
The Horn of Africa has been on the verge of crisis for some time. There have been several consecutive failed rainy seasons, and we've come to a situation right now where we're having a significant amount of food insecurity, human displacement.
The IRC says the lack of rainfall has led to the driest conditions in 40 years in parts of Somalia and Ethiopia. At least 3 million people have been affected by drought, and more than 170,000 have fled their homes in search of water, pasture and humanitarian assistance. 47-year-old Noor Ahmed fled his hometown with his 60 cattle. He says he's transported his cattle from Birgod to Horai's town. In Horai's district, the local administration and the people welcomed us. I'm still here. He says there are some challenges. The cattle are finding it difficult to adapt to the area, and we need some medicine. We use water from the borehole, but we don't have enough storage. He says if we can get a place to store the water, that could help us a lot. Crothers says women and children are the most affected by the drought.
Particularly the children under five are the most hit. It's destroying livelihoods. Crops, herds of cattle that were once large have been diminished. So it's a rather desperate situation. I think, as usual, it's particularly the women and children that are getting hit the hardest.
Abdiaziz Bashir is a businessman based in the port city of Kismayo, who deals with buying and selling of livestock. He lost 99 animals to the drought. He says, I had 118 livestock, only 19 survived. I lost the rest of the drought. I'm yet to recover from that loss, Bashir says. He adds, the only good thing is that I no longer spend money on food to feed the remaining animals. They can get water and pasture for now. Aid agencies in Ethiopia and Somalia says food prices have gone up and some people cannot afford basic foods to feed their families. The IRC says it has launched a response in Ethiopia's Somali region and says more money is needed to scale up humanitarian assistance in other areas. The aid agencies call for more funding to support cash assistance, food, water and sanitation facilities to combat health challenges. Mohamed Yusuf for VA News, Nairobi.
The World Health Organization, WHO, says a blockade by the Ethiopian government keeping medicine and other life-saving supplies from reaching Tigray has created a nightmare in the war-ravaged region. The French news agency AFP quoting WHO chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said, the people of Tigray have been denied food and medicine for more than a year. The WHO chief, who comes from the Tigray region but insists he is not biased, stressed the situation is desperate. Tedros also highlighted the ongoing daily drone strikes there. Humanitarian access must always be allowed, even during conflict, Tedros insisted, pointing out that even at the height of the devastating conflicts in Syria and Yemen, the UN Health Agency had always been able to send assistance to those in need. Mali has accused France of breaching its airspace and threatened unspecified consequences if it happens again. Annie Rittenberg reports from Bamako, Mali.
Mali's military government Wednesday condemned France for flying a military plane into the country from Ivory Coast this week. In a statement, government spokesman Colonel Abdoulaye Maiga called the flight Tuesday from Abidjan to Mali's city of Gao a clear breach of its airspace. Maiga also accused the French military plane of switching off its communication with Mali's aviation authorities. He threatened consequences if the incident is repeated, saying Mali's government would refuse any liability relating to the risks to which the perpetrators of these practices could expose themselves. A French military official who refused to be named denied the claim to Agence France-Presse, saying all procedures were respected and that Malian authorities had approved the flight. The French military maintains a base in Gao to help Mali fight Islamist insurgents after gradually withdrawing troops from other bases in northern Mali. The statement came just hours after a West African aviation authority accused the French military plane of violating regional sanctions against Mali. The Dakar, Senegal-based Agency for Aerial Navigation Safety in Africa and Madagascar also told Mali's National Civil Aviation Agency it was not notified of the flight in advance. The Economic Community of West African States Sunday banned transport and trade between member states and Mali after the military leaders delayed elections. Leaders of Mali's August 2020 coup promised elections in February, but last week announced a plan to hold the polls in 2026. France is supporting the ECOWAS sanctions against Mali, and its national airline, Air France, Wednesday suspended all flights to Mali until further notice. Annie Reisenberg for VOA News, Bamako, Mali.
The South African Development Community, SADC, yesterday extended its military mission in northern Mozambique by 3 months. Regional troops, mainly from South Africa, plus soldiers from Rwanda, have been in resource-rich but poverty-stricken Cabo Delgado province since late July to counter fighters linked to the Islamic State or ISIS International Terror Network. The insurgents claim to be fighting for access to wealth from oil and natural gas deposits for locals, but have killed many and displaced tens of thousands since 2017. Darren Taylor reports.
Independent intelligence agencies estimate about 2,000 militants are in Cabo Delgado, but they say the ISIS-backed jihadists are spread out across the vast province, making it extremely difficult for SADC, Rwandese, and Mozambican troops to track them. Professor of International Law, Andre Thomashausen, has extensive on-the-ground experience of Cabo Delgado. He says South Africa's 1,500 troops are severely under-equipped, with just 2 helicopters, both of which have been damaged by enemy fire. Thomashausen says at least 1 South African soldier has been killed in action. Heavy rain, he says, is making counter-terrorism operations extremely difficult, if not impossible.
And some of the vehicles are not suited to this mission. Plus, of course, they are understaffed. They lack the funds to do more. With the little they have done remarkably well to stabilize things in the area of their operation, which is, of course, very limited.
He says South African special forces have so far done most of the fighting.
We have effectively about 280 fighting personnel for such an area cannot achieve very much. And this is the main constraint. This is why Mozambique is increasingly relying on the support from Rwanda, and they've just extended the mission of Rwanda by another 6 months.
Thomashausen says for the mission to meet with any kind of real success, South Africa needs a lot more help from its neighbors. Last year, President Cyril Ramaphosa put the budget of each 3-month deployment of South African troops at 984 million rands, about $66 million. Thomashausen says the country can't afford to spend money like this to essentially secure foreign interests in Mozambique.
The interests are very, very large, some of the world's largest oil and gas companies. So we would expect from South Africa that this becomes more inclusive and that countries also contribute directly to the cost.
At home, the South African government's been criticized for not giving its soldiers more power and resources to hunt down and kill the terrorists. Thomashausen doesn't agree with the criticism.
It follows our human rights culture in South Africa that we don't just go and pursue a scorched earth policy and simply burn down villages that we might suspect of supporting insurgents, that we do respect human rights, and that we are also aware, we have a sensitivity in South Africa of the huge humanitarian challenge. If you clear an area of insurgent action, then once you've cleared it, there has to be a humanitarian action to follow that will rebuild infrastructure. Otherwise, we are creating a no man's land, a complete wasteland.
He says it's going to take a long time for peace and development to take hold in Cabo Delgado.
This is an issue that results from 30 years of misgovernance. Mozambique is not a model country. It's incurred an international debt of 2,000 million euros, 2 billion euros. and it cannot account for this money. And it is now relying on South Africa to solve an insurgency problem, which is the result of underdevelopment, of actually complete neglect. Half the population of Cabo Delgado have fled. The remaining people are scattered, are hiding, are living on the most basic form of existence that one can imagine.
Even if all the ISIS jihadists are killed tomorrow, says Thomashausen, bad conditions will persist in Cabo Delgado, which needs a massive international humanitarian effort, not a long war. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Fears of xenophobic violence, retribution and loss of jobs have risen among immigrants in South Africa as some politicians demand that foreign nationals leave or be taken out of their jobs. The increasing calls come at a time when the Department of Home Affairs has also launched a crackdown on illegal immigration, resulting in the arrest and deportation of thousands of Zimbabweans. And the government has terminated the work, study and business permits for more than 200,000 Zimbabweans. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
Over the years, South Africa has become Africa's economic hub and an epitome of democracy, attracting millions of economic migrants and asylum seekers. With the general economic decline around the world worsened by COVID-19, a feud over jobs is growing between migrants and locals. This has led to xenophobic violence in the past, and the current tensions seem to be heading the same direction. Social media is awash with anti-immigrant sentiment, and some locals have formed groupings like South Africa First and Operation Dudula with the sole aim of sending foreign nationals home. But the growing number of politicians desperate to woo voters are really stoking the fire. This call, made at a recent post-election rally by the Economic Freedom Fighters party leader Julius Malema, known for defending immigrants staying in South Africa, has left many of them feeling exposed.
We are visiting the hospitality industry. We want the owner of Hilton Hotel in Durban to tell us how many South Africans are working here.
The hospitality sector is dominated by Zimbabwean immigrants, who say a number of politicians have made frightening comments at recent election rallies. This is what the leader of the Patriotic Alliance Party, Gayton McKenzie, told a rally ahead of the recent local government elections.
You are going home, you are going home, you are going home. We have enough teachers, we have enough nurses here. When you come here, you must come as a legal foreigner and work a skill that we don't possess here in South Africa.
And the leader of Action SA, Herman Mashaba, was very direct and unapologetic when his party launched its manifesto ahead of the same elections.
Action SA will establish a dedicated unit within the Metro Police Department to process any undocumented foreign national arrested for a crime.
Nkosi Ncube, a Zimbabwean national and spokesperson of the Patriotic Front Party, told VOA that immigrants are extremely worried.
The lives of migrants in South Africa are no longer as safe. It's getting into a new level, which is very worrisome, especially considering that in the past we've seen operations that have left a number of migrants dead, buildings burnt, some properties looted.
And another Zimbabwean, Gretman Mkwebu, told VOA that the situation seems to be getting out of hand.
It's their last chance of trying to make Zimbabweans act on their country's situation. Because the more they stay in their countries, no solution to Zimbabwe. And where's COVID hit more and they are trying to accommodate their own people.
Others point fingers at the government after the Department of Home Affairs recently arrested and deported thousands of migrants who entered the country illegally. It also recently terminated permits issued to thousands of Zimbabweans, attracting criticism from those who see the action as fitting the public narrative that jobs that South Africans desperately need are occupied by foreign nationals. The government insists it is only applying the country's laws and that all those coming to the country legally are welcome. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at